Okay, I guess we can go ahead and get started. I'd like to continue the discussion from yesterday on solving wave propagation problems in heterogeneous media. Don't have the outline here. Yesterday, what we did was to look at some examples of wave propagation in heterogeneous media, and in particular, I kind of focused on one-dimensional problems in a layered medium. In the case of elasticity problems, both linear and nonlinear elasticity problems, we saw that when you have layers of different material, you get reflections at the interfaces between the layers, which leads to dispersion and effective behavior that's different from the behavior in either medium separately. And so you get an effective wave speed that's different from the wave speeds in the layers, perhaps. And you can look at some homogenization theory to understand that a bit. And in the nonlinear case, there are interesting sort of solitary waves that arise from the interaction between the nonlinearity of the medium and the dispersion. I showed various pictures yesterday of computations, and the computations there were sort of an experimental way of investigating things, but I didn't say anything at all really about how they were computed, which is really what my expertise is more on, is how to develop algorithms for solving these kind of problems. And so today I'll talk more about the hyperbolic structure of these problems and how it leads to good finite value methods for solving problems of this nature. And in particular, talk about what's called the Riemann problem, which is a particular special case of the equation with special piecewise constant initial data that's kind of the building block for the numerical methods that we use. Then I'll also talk a bit at the end about how that kind of Riemann solution idea might be useful in understanding sort of the behavior of later media and can perhaps be related to homogenization theory in the long run. And then on Thursday, I'll talk some about multidimensional problems, so today will be still entirely one-dimensional. Just to briefly review, if someone wasn't here yesterday, the equations, again, of one-dimensional elasticity is one example of the system of conservation laws we'll be looking at, where, in this case, the conserved quantities are the strain, epsilon, and the momentum, and we can write, we have some constitutive relation that relates the stress at any point to the strain at that point, and in the heterogeneous case, that constitutive relation depends explicitly on x if we have different materials at different points. In the linear case, just have something like Hooke's law that the stress is a constant times epsilon, though that might vary with space. That's the notation, and then the equations are derived. Again, I want to focus here on the part that relates directly to conservation laws and numerical methods, that the dynamic equation coming from, which you can think of as being force equals mass times acceleration, you can also derive in terms of a conservation law that the time derivative of the integral of momentum, which is a conserved quantity over some region, is equal to the difference in the stress at the two ends of that section you're looking at, which the stress in this case serves as the flux of momentum, and so the only change in the integral of that quantity is due to the flux through the endpoint. Otherwise, it's conserved. And if things are smooth, we can rewrite this integral in this form, which gives us this differential form of the conservation law that the time derivative of the conserved quantity plus the x derivative of the flux is zero. And that, together with this kinematic equation, gives us a system of conservation laws. But this, again, this is sort of important to think of deriving conservation laws in this form. And for other conservation laws, for example, conservation of mass, momentum, and energy in the Euler equations for gas dynamics, it's really the integral form of the conservation law that makes physical sense or is the basis of the derivation. And the differential form is something that you can derive from that when things are smooth. But in many cases, we're interested in problems with shock waves where things are definitely not smooth. And so the integral form is really more fundamental and is used in developing the numerical methods we'll look at. And again, just still reviewing, it's hyperbolic if we can write the flux function. We look at the Jacobian of that, differentiating with respect to the variables. We get some matrix. It's hyperbolic if that matrix has real eigenvalues and a complete linearly independent set of eigenvectors, in which case we can decompose things, at least in the linear case, into waves moving at speeds that are given by the eigenvalues of the matrix and that have some shape that's given by the corresponding eigenvector, as we looked at a bit last time. So I mentioned the Euler equations of gas dynamics. That's a system of nonlinear hyperbolic conservation laws that's been very extensively studied. It's important, of course, in aerodynamics and in many mechanical engineering problems, detonation problems, all sorts of problems involving compressible gases. If you include viscosity, then you end up with a parabolic system of equations. But in many cases, you can ignore viscosity, and then you get a hyperbolic system. And these equations are for the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy, rho, rho u, and e. And the flux function is given by this vector, which involves the same variables and, in addition, involves the pressure of the gas. And so to complete this system, you need what's called an equation of state, which is like a constitutive relation that we had relating stress and strain. Here, the equation of state relates the pressure to the conserved quantity. For an ideal gas, for example, the equation of state just says that the total energy is the internal energy plus the kinetic energy, and the internal energy is related to the pressure as P over gamma minus 1, where gamma is some constant depending on the gas, about 1.4 in air. So if you look at this flux function, which can be derived as the proper flux of these conserved quantities, then you can compute the Jacobian matrix, and you find that it has eigenvalues u minus c, u, and u plus c, a 3-by-3 matrix, three eigenvalues, where c is the sound speed, is the square root of gamma p over rho for an ideal gas. So gamma p plays the role of the bulk modulus we had for elasticity, where, remember, the sound speed was the square root of k over rho. And the fact that the eigenvalues look like this, if we looked at linearized Euler equations, we get a system of equations that models just acoustic waves in a gas, and the wave speeds would be u minus c and u plus c correspond to sound waves moving in the two directions, but they're moving relative to the gas. So if the gas is moving at some velocity u, then the sound waves move at speed c relative to that, and there's another wave moving at speed u that corresponds to bulk motion of the gas itself. Now, this is a nonlinear system of equations. It's a little complicated. You can't write down exact solutions except in very special cases. But one special case where you can derive exact solutions is this Riemann problem, which I'd mentioned. In the case of gas dynamics, in one special case anyway, it's what's called a shock tube problem experimentally. You just take a tube, put a membrane in the center of the tube, put a gas on either side that are at different pressures, say maybe even different gases, but say it's the same gas, but just with different pressure, but zero velocity initially, and then you break that membrane, then the gas will tend to start flowing from the high pressure region to the lower pressure region. And so we're looking at initial data that's just piecewise constant with some density, zero velocity, some pressure on the left, and a different density and velocity and pressure perhaps on the right. And it turns out that this problem has a solution that can be calculated. If we look now in x and t, so at time 0, we just have a discontinuity between these two gases. What happens as time evolves is that you get a set of waves that move out, just as we had in the elastic problem, or you would have in acoustics problem. In fact, if the jump in pressure is very, very small, then what you get is basically two acoustic waves, one moving in each direction. But more generally, you have a shock wave moving in one direction, a rarefaction wave moving in the other, and what's called the contact discontinuity in between. Explain those better on this slide, which shows the structure. So this is at some instant in time a little later. If we look at how the pressure, density, and velocity are distributed, what we see is this wave that's moving to the right. There's a discontinuity in the pressure in all three variables. Actually, that's the shock wave. The wave that's moving to the left is a smooth expansion or rarefaction of the gas. And in between, there's a contact discontinuity where there's a jump in density, but pressure and velocity are continuous. And if you look at how particles of gas would move, we have particles distributed according to 1 over the density, so farther apart means lower density. Then initially, these particles are are stationary because the velocity is zero until the shock wave hits, at which point they're accelerated to some non-zero velocity. In the other gas, they're initially stationary until the rarefaction wave passes by, in which case they're also accelerated to that same velocity, but through a smooth rarefaction rather than through a sharp shock wave. And in between, there's this line where the particles are simply moving parallel. They're moving with that same velocity on both sides, but there's a jump in density. You can see the spacing of particles is still different on the two sides, and that's the line across which the two gases are in contact with each other. So the interesting thing about conservation laws of this form is that even for highly nonlinear systems of equations, if you look at the special data, piecewise constant data, you get solutions that have this similarity structure. The solution is a function of x over t only and is constant along any ray from the origin. There's some rays across which the solution jumps from one value to another, but otherwise it's piecewise constant or maybe varying through a rarefaction wave, but still constant along each of these rays. And so this type of solution, which you can actually calculate, for the Euler equations you can't actually write down an explicit solution, but you can easily write down a little nonlinear iteration that will solve to any accuracy you want for what the solution of this Riemann problem is. And this Riemann problem tells a lot of information about what's going on with the shocks and rarefaction waves and so on, the structure of the waves that are coming out of the solution. So this problem is really the basis of the numerical methods that are used. Now, before talking about those kinds of methods, let me just show what sort of thing you get if you use simpler methods. This is, again, the shock tube problem, but now computed approximately using some numerical method. So here's what the density should look like at some particular time. The dots here are what you get if you use a grid with, I think there were 50 points or so in here, using just the first-order upwind method, first-order Godunov method, which I'll describe in a minute. And what you see typically is that you get something that looks sort of reasonable, but the discontinuities are smeared out quite a bit. It has a lot of numerical diffusion, and also that's even a lot of smearing in the rarefaction wave. If you try to improve it by using a standard second-order centered scheme, as I mentioned last time, that typically gives dispersion in the numerical method, and that shows up in the form of oscillations, where you have discontinuities in the solution. The numerical method will be oscillatory if you use something like a Lax-Wondroff method or standard second-order method. So the sort of methods I'll be describing are what are called high-resolution methods that do a much better job than either of these. They're actually obtained by sort of combining these two methods, but in a way that gives results that look more like this, that keep the discontinuities fairly sharp. There's a little bit of smearing, but not too much, and that also capture the rarefaction wave quite nicely. So these methods are what are called finite volume methods. They're somewhat different from finite difference methods, although often you can interpret them as being finite difference methods, but the basic idea in deriving a finite difference method is that if we're approximating Q of xt, we think of Qin as being some pointwise approximation at a point, and derivatives in the differential equation are replaced by finite differences. Q dx is just Qi minus 1 divided by delta x or something like that, and that gives you a set of algebraic equations that you can solve. But doing that replacement by finite differences is sort of assuming that things are behaving smoothly. And near discontinuities, where things aren't behaving smoothly, you get poor results typically. So the idea in the finite volume method instead is to approximate cell averages. So Qin is an approximation to the integral over a grid cell from xi minus a half to I plus a half divided by the length of that grid cell. And then we use the integral form of the conservation law to say that the time derivative of the integral over this one grid cell is given by the difference in flux at the left and right edge of the cell. Remember, this is the integral form of the conservation law is really a fundamental physical law that we're trying to solve. And this makes sense even when the solution involves shock waves, whereas finite differences aren't going to be good approximations across the shock wave. So from this, we got the conservation law. We derived that earlier, but instead of deriving this form and approximating it by finite differences. Instead, we can work with this form directly and say that numerically we should take a cell average at time n and update it to a cell average at time n plus 1 by modifying that average by fluxes at the left and right edge. And if you do that appropriately, it has a number of advantages. One advantage is that driving it this way, you can get methods that are exactly conservative in a discrete sense, and that turns out to be very useful, in fact necessary, if you're trying to capture shock waves on a fixed grid. If you use a method that isn't in conservation form, then you can end up with solutions that look very nice but are completely wrong in that the shock might be in the wrong location altogether. Whereas if you use conservative methods based on this principle, then you're guaranteed of getting things may not be exactly right, but at least they'll be smeared out about the right locations. Let me pause for a brief commercial here. Most of the methods that I'll be talking about today are described in a lot more detail in a book that's coming out this spring by Cambridge University Press, which is a greatly expanded version of the ETH notes I wrote some time ago. So if you're interested, it should be available soon. Also, there's various papers on my webpage that concern various aspects of what I've been talking about. Okay, now, the basic method of this finite volume type based on using Riemann problems is due to Godunov in the 1950s, who proposed this as a way to solve gas dynamics problems. There were a lot of problems with exactly the kind of difficulties I showed earlier of solutions either being very smeared out or highly oscillatory when people were trying to solve gas dynamics problems. And the idea of Godunov was to approximate the solution by a value qin, that's a cell average, as I mentioned, but now view that as defining a piecewise constant function. So each grid cell has a value qin, that's a constant value over that grid cell, and the next grid cell over has a different value. Then if we think of solving forward in time from time tn to some short time later, then what we have near each of these interfaces is a Riemann problem or a shock tube problem where you've got piecewise constant data, and what you'll get is a set of waves coming out at finite speeds from that Riemann problem. And so if you can solve the Riemann problem, then you can construct the solution locally here over short time. And if you don't take too large a time step, these waves won't interact with each other. And so you can construct the exact solution at this time, and you can average that solution to get your new cell average at the next time. And that method, well, it smears things out quite a bit. It's only a first-order accurate method, but at least it avoided a lot of the problems that people were seeing prior to that with oscillatory solutions and with numerical solutions that didn't even approximate the right thing because the shocks weren't in the right place, it wasn't conservative or something like that. And what's been done more recently, well, starting in the 70s and 80s, is to develop high-resolution versions of this idea where you can get better accuracy but still have the nice properties of being conservative and non-oscillatory. So the Riemann problem more generally is the conservation law, whatever problem we're looking at, together with this special data that's just piecewise constant, two-state QL and QR. And in general, it has a similarity solution of this form. You just plug in and see that, in fact, you can solve fine solutions of that form. Constant along rays. And so in general, you can think of that as being constant states separated by discontinuities that are propagating. In some cases, some of these waves should be rarefaction waves. Actually, numerically, we tend to use approximate Riemann solvers rather than actually solving exactly the Riemann problem, say in gas dynamics, at every grid cell, every time step, which would be very expensive. We use certain approximations that, in fact, just generate discontinuities that propagate at some speeds given by eigenvalues and eigenvectors of some approximate Jacobian matrix. And then we have to worry a bit about what happens if there should really be a rarefaction wave. You may have to do some what's called an entropy fix to make sure you're getting the right physical solution satisfying an entropy condition there too. But I'm not going to go into those details today. For our purposes, we can think of the Riemann solution as just being a set of waves which are jump discontinuities propagating at fixed speeds. And there's a jump condition, the Rankine-Hugoniot jump condition, that has to hold across any wave, any discontinuity that's propagating with constant speed, that's the solution to this, has to satisfy the condition that the jump in flux across the wave, evaluate the flux function on each side and subtract, that has to be S, some scalar, which is the speed of propagation, times the jump in Q across the wave. And you can derive this just from the conservation law. If you just integrate over a small rectangle around this wave, this relation drops out easily. In the case of a linear problem, where F of Q is just some matrix A times Q, this simplifies even further. The jump condition says that the jump in F, which is the jump in A times Q, which is just A times the jump in Q if A is constant, has to be S times the jump in Q. Well, that means that S has to be an eigenvalue of the matrix A, and the jump in Q has to be corresponding eigenvector. So we recover this idea that the eigenvalues of the matrix tell us the propagation speeds. And for this Riemann problem, we can solve it explicitly for any two states to the left and the right by taking the jump in those two states and writing it as a linear combination of the eigenvectors, because the jump across each wave has to be an eigenvector. And so solving the Riemann problem amounts to finding the strengths of these waves, the alpha values, so that the total jump in Q can be written as a linear combination of those eigenvectors. But if it's a hyperbolic problem, the eigenvectors are linearly independent, and so we can always do that decomposition for any states Q left and Q right. So these waves I'll typically call W super P in the P family, P going from 1 up to M if it's a system of M equations. So Godunov's method again takes the cell average, solves the Riemann problem, averages the solution to get a new cell average. And there are various ways that you can sort of interpret this method. So we start by solving the Riemann problem at each interface. That gives us some waves and corresponding speeds. Then you could think of doing what I just said, construct the exact solution and integrate over a grid cell to get a new cell average. That seems a bit complicated, though, because your solution along here is something that's piecewise constant but varying through the cell. So rather than actually doing that, there are easier ways to implement it. One way is that you can rewrite it or view it in terms of computing a flux at the interfaces. As I said, we can think of updating the cell average by just differencing the fluxes at the two edges. And it turns out you can compute the numerical flux for Godunov's method. It's just the flux function evaluated along at the value of Q that propagates with speed zero along the interface. And that's a constant value in time since we have a similarity solution. And so you can easily calculate the flux out of this Riemann solution. And you can write it in this conservative flux differencing form. Or another way that's actually used in the type of methods I've been looking at, which is equivalent for conservation laws, but extends also to hyperbolic problems that aren't in conservation form, as some of these problems in heterogeneous media have that property. Rather than writing it as a difference of fluxes, since you may not have a flux function if it's not in conservation form, it can be extended to basically update the cell average by what we call A plus delta Q at the left edge and A minus delta Q at the right edge. These are really just the accumulation or the total effect of all the waves that are coming into the cell from the left edge and from the right edge. We just add up all the waves multiplied by the speed they're traveling at, but only take the positive part for the right-going fluctuations and only take the negative part for the left-going fluctuations. So this is just another way of writing this method. It's basically looking at each of these waves affects the value in the cell only for the portion of the cell that it's covered, which is S, the speed at which it's traveling, times delta T, the time step. And so its effect on the cell average is S delta T divided by delta X times the jump across the wave, dividing by delta X to average it over the grid cell. So you basically have each wave should have an effect that's its speed multiplied by the wave times delta t divided by delta x. That's where this comes from. But it's just a more general way of writing the same method. Okay, the problem with this method, though, however you write it, is that it's only first-order accurate. Basically, we've used this Riemann solution, got a lot of detailed information about what's going on, but now we're just averaging that solution at the next time step. And when you do that averaging, you're introducing a lot of smearing, dissipation, and you get very smeared out results. So you can try to do better. Here's an example for just the advection equation. Advection equation is just qt plus u qx equals 0, where u is some constant, just a scalar equation. You get a solution that consists of a wave propagating at constant speed u. Picture, I guess, down at the bottom is the picture showing in the going from time tn to tn plus 1. At each interface, we have a Riemann problem that consists, whose solution consists of just a single wave propagating at speed u with a scalar equation. And if you work out what Godunov's method is, it ends up being just what's called the first-order upwind method for the advection equation, which you can also view as a finite difference method where we've used qi minus 1 over delta x as the approximation to q dx. But another way to interpret it is that we've reconstructed from the cell averages, the q values, which are the green circles here, we've reconstructed this piecewise constant function, and then we've solved the equation, the advection equation, exactly with that piecewise constant function, so everything just shifts over a distance, u times delta t, and then we average that onto the grid. So we take this function, average it onto the grid, and we get some new cell average that's in between somewhere. And when we do that, we'll get a new approximation, but this averaging introduces a lot of smearing. So the idea to get better accuracy is to do a better reconstruction. Instead of reconstructing a piecewise linear function or a piecewise constant function from these cell values, instead construct some piecewise linear function from these same cell values. So the green line now, since we're lined up properly, should pass through the same cell averages, has the same average values on each grid cell, but I've introduced some slopes. And the way I've chosen the slopes here is to look at each cell value and look at the value to the right and choose the slope based on those two values. So here I've chosen the slope based on these two values. Here I've chosen the slope based on these two values. Here I've chosen slope 0. Those two values are the same, so on. So now you can take that, which should be a better approximation of the way the function's really behaving, at least where things are smooth, and solve the advection equation with that, which means we're going to shift that function over distance u delta t, and now average that function back onto the grid. Well, if you do that, then in regions where things are behaving smoothly, you'll probably get a better approximation than using this. But you can see that in this cell here, for example, the cell average of that green function is going to be above the original function values. We've introduced a new local maximum there that's higher than we had originally, and that's the beginning of an oscillation. And in later time steps, that would grow, and we'd end up getting oscillations arising from using this method. So the way that I've chosen the slopes here, by looking to the right, in the case when things are advecting to the right, is actually gives you, if you write down what the formula is, you can calculate here what you get if you average this piecewise linear function, and what you get is exactly the Lax-Wendroff method, the standard second-order accurate method. So you can see that Lax-Wendroff will give oscillations near. In this case, we don't even really have a discontinuity. We just have a local maximum here. But if you had a sharp discontinuity in the function, you get oscillations arising there. So this sort of idea of introducing slopes works well where things are smooth. But if you're near a discontinuity or near a local maximum or something, then it can introduce oscillations. So the idea of the high-resolution methods is to introduce some sort of limiter, which you can describe here most easily by saying, rather than always looking to the right and choosing the slope based on this data and this data, let's also look to the left and look at the slope based on those two points. Turns out if you always look to the left, you get a different method called the Beam-Warming method for solving the advection equation. If you always look to the right, you get Lax-Wendroff. But if you look in both directions and now compare those two slopes, and rather than always using one or always using the other, you say, let's use the one that's smaller, for example, then up here near this point where the oscillation was arising, we'd be looking to the left as well, where we'd see a slope zero, so we'd end up using zero slope there, and we wouldn't introduce an oscillation. And if you compare values that way and apply some limiter, which says let's look at both values and choose one or the other depending on how the solution is behaving, then you can get much better accuracy without much more work. So don't worry too much about the notation here. Again, this is written in the sort of more general form that turns out applies and extends very easily to general hyperbolic systems, whether or not they're in conservation form. Actually, these methods also have very low dispersion. I'll show an example later that shows that you really get very little dispersion compared to something like Lax-Wendroff, which is very dispersive. The way that the limiter is applied turns the method into a nonlinear method, even if it's a linear advection equation that we're solving, since we're looking at how the data behaves and comparing behavior of the data to the left and the right. It's no longer a linear method, even though it's a linear PDE that we're solving. And that nonlinearity actually helps quite a bit in eliminating what you would normally see in the way of either diffusion or dispersion. Right, and near a discontinuity, we're sort of using a one-sided difference in one direction to the left of the discontinuity and in the other direction to the right. And so you're, in a sense, avoiding introducing dispersion at all because you're using the right data on each side. We'll see an example in a minute that shows that it has not only lower dissipation but also lower dispersion. But in terms of the sort of religious question about what kind of errors are better, I guess one thing that I feel strongly in terms of looking at these methods is that one thing you can't just look at is order of accuracy. That methods that are formally high order accuracy may, especially for problems with discontinuities, but even for problems where the solutions are smooth, may behave worse than methods that have a lower formal order of accuracy, but that are better designed somehow. But I'll say a bit more about that as we go along. Okay, so in general, solving the Riemann problem gives us a way of splitting up the jump in queue between two cells as a bunch of waves, which are moving at some speeds. And I've defined these fluctuations as sort of the net effect of the left-going and right-going waves. And the sum of those, it turns out, should be the difference in fluxes if we have a conservation law and we want to be conservative. And if so, the method reduces to being in conservation form. But more generally, the algorithm has this form where the first terms are what I wrote down before is Godunov's method, and now I've added another term which is based on taking these same waves but possibly applying a limiter to them, as I'll say more about in a moment, and looking at this combination, taking the wave, multiplying by the speed or its absolute value times 1 minus delta t over delta x times the speed. It turns out if you forget about the limiter and just use the full wave here, then this is giving exactly the term that's needed to take this upwind method and turn it into the Lax-Wendroff method. So without a limiter, this would be a second order Lax-Wendroff method, at least for a linear problem. But with the limiter, it's not, but the idea is we write this method as upwind or Godunov, which behaves well near discontinuities in the sense of not introducing oscillations, at least, plus a correction term that where things are smooth turns it into a second order method, but where things are not behaving smoothly has a limiter applied that keeps things looking nice. So again, the limiter amounts to, here we are at some interface where we've solved the Riemann problem. We've got some particular wave, say a right-moving wave, and we want to use this wave now in this correction formula. But rather than just using this total wave, we're going to take this wave and we're going to compare it to the corresponding wave coming from the next Riemann problem over, looking in the upwind direction. And by comparing these two, if the two are sort of similar magnitude, then we might want to include the whole wave or most of it to get second-order accuracy. But if these are very different, then maybe we're near a discontinuity, a shock wave or something, and we might want to reduce the amount of the wave that's used. And there's a whole bunch of different limiter functions that were developed again back in the late 70s, early 80s largely, that work well for these sorts of things. So here's one example. It's a simple problem. Upwind advection equation, again, on a periodic domain, so things are just wrapping around and around, and starting with data that has a smooth hump and a square pulse. And at time one, it should have come right back to where it started, but the symbols here show the numerical results obtained at time one. So you can see that with the upwind or Godunov method, there's a lot of smearing. With Lax Wendroff, we're getting much better accuracy where things are smooth, but we're getting oscillations near these discontinuities. If you use a limiter method, then what you get depends on which one of these particular limiters you use. The one I sort of briefly described as saying, look at both slopes and take the one that's smaller in magnitude is called the min-mod limiter. Gives results that look like this. It's not doing quite as well as Lax-Wendroff here, but it's doing a lot better over here and a lot better than this too. There's various other limiters, the super B limiter, the monotonized centered limiter, so on, which give slightly better looking results. This is after time one when it's done one revolution. This is after time 10 revolutions with this MC limiter, and you see it's still getting a fairly good representation given how coarse the grid is. So here's the picture that sort of shows that also dispersion is reduced by these methods. This is smooth data, just a wave packet, with, again, the advection equation. And at time t equals 1, the upwind method has damped it out quite a bit. At time t equals 10, if you take 10 revolutions, you've just lost everything with the upwind method. With Lax-Wendroff, it's looking okay at time 1, but by time 10, you see that the dispersion in Lax-Wendroff has given the wrong group velocity, basically, and this pulse is traveling at the wrong speed and ends up in the wrong place. If you use one of these limiter methods, here's what we get at time 1 and at time 10. This is a fairly coarse grid here, so I mean we have lost quite a bit of the peak here, but notice it's in exactly the right place, even though it's somewhat smeared out. It's in the right place. It's not way off the way Lax-Wendroff is. And for a lot of problems, that's quite important. Getting waves to be in the right location is sometimes even more important than really getting exactly the amplitude correct. Although this gets much better results than any of these linear methods. And again, this is to get this sort of behavior really depends on the nonlinearity of the method. Oh, and by the way, again, here, since this is a smooth solution and Lax-Wendroff is formally second-order accurate, you might think that, at least as the grid gets finer, that Lax-Wendroff would do much better than this method, which formally isn't second-order because of the limiters thrown in. It has a formal accuracy somewhat less than 2. But comparing these two, I'd say this looks better on this grid. And even as you refine the grid, you have to go down to very, very fine grids, much finer than you would want to use in practice before Lax-Wendroff really looks better. OK, so let's go back to a heterogeneous medium. I've written things in a bit different notation here than yesterday. But it's basically the same equations. P now is pressure and just an acoustics equation if you relinearize the gas dynamics. But it's the same as what we had yesterday. P corresponds to the negative of the stress minus sigma. So we get a slightly different looking system, but it's still equivalent to the second order wave equation. And the sound speed is square root of k over rho. But again, prefer to keep it as this first order hyperbolic system with this matrix, and then we see the eigenvalues are plus and minus c, and the eigenvectors depend on the impedance z rho times c. If we look at solving the Riemann problem, first of all, for a constant homogeneous medium, A is constant. As I talked about yesterday, you can calculate the exact solution for the linear problem just by diagonalizing the matrix and rewriting the equations as advection equations for the left and right going characteristic variables. In the context of the Riemann problem, that amounts to taking the jump in Q across the interface here, which is some jump in P and jump in velocity, and writing it as a linear combination of the two eigenvectors, right, eigenvectors of this matrix. And again, you can calculate those coefficients easily for any jump in Q, since these eigenvectors are linearly independent. And that gives you the strength of the two waves, which are, again, moving with speeds minus C and plus C. And there's a constant state in between, Q star, that you can look at as either being QI minus 1 plus the jump across this wave, or QI minus the jump across this wave. Okay, if you look at a heterogeneous media, what were we doing to calculate solutions we saw yesterday? Well, you can do much the same thing. You can think of each grid cell as having its own distinct value of density in both modulus, rho I and ki. So the neighboring cell has different values. And we've got a Riemann problem now in which we've got both two different values of Q, but also two different values of the material parameters. But we still can find a solution that consists of two waves, one wave that's moving at the sound speed of this material to the right, and one moving at the sound speed of that material to the left. And it should still be true that in between those waves, the pressure and velocity have to be continuous. It's the right jump condition at the interface. So should have continuity there. And so we can take the jump in Q, jump in pressure and velocity, and write it as a linear combination of two eigenvectors. But now the eigenvector corresponding to the left-going wave involves the impedance in the material on the left. The eigenvector for the right-going wave involves the impedance of the material to the right. But those are still linearly independent, so we can find these coefficients for any states QI minus 1 and QI. So the solution of the Riemann problem extends very directly to a heterogeneous medium where we have a discontinuity in the material at the interface. So we saw various examples that were calculated with that idea yesterday, but here's another example. This is the pulse in pressure with, in this case, just a single interface between two different materials, but lots of grid cells. So the x's here are the values in the grid cell, and this pulse splits up into two waves moving outwards. They look the same because it's a homogeneous material so far, but then the right-going pulse hits this interface and only part of it's transmitted and part of it's reflected, and numerically it calculates that transmission and reflection sort of automatically, because when we solve the Riemann problem between the two grid cells that are here right at the interface, in the process of solving that Riemann problem, we're essentially computing the reflected and transmitted parts properly, splitting up the waves into the parts going in each direction. And we see here that we get pretty good resolution, even though this wave has infinite slope as it comes in here. We're not generating any oscillations, and we're getting fairly good resolution. Okay. I have that, and I'll show that to you in a minute. Yeah. Because it's interesting. You can actually analyze, you can calculate the reflection and transmission coefficients directly. But before doing that, let me just briefly say how this extends to a nonlinear problem, where we have a flux function that's nonlinear in Q but also depends on X, such as a nonlinear stress-strain relationship in a heterogeneous medium. Then again, you get this sort of generalized Riemann problem where you've got an interface between two different conservation laws, one involving the flux function Fi of Q in the cell on the right, one involving Fi minus 1 of Q over here. And so again, you expect to get a set of waves propagating out where, away from the interface, each of these waves is just a standard nonlinear shock wave or whatever in the material that's defined by the proper flux function on that side. But then you also, in this case, can have a discontinuity in Q across the interface. For example, in the nonlinear elasticity case, the conserved quantities, remember, were the strain and the momentum, and those are not continuous across the interface, even though the stress and the velocity are. So if we work in terms of the conserved quantities, then we have to worry about the fact that Q might end up being discontinuous across the interface. But there's a condition that the flux function should be continuous. The flux in the elasticity case is exactly sigma and mu. So you want to solve the Riemann problem to find waves that satisfy the proper jump conditions, Rankine-Hugoniot jump conditions, relative to each material, but with an additional constraint at the interface and an additional possible jump across the interface. You can actually think of this jump as being a wave moving with speed zero, and so the jump in F has to be zero times the jump in Q, which is why the flux has to be continuous there. However, rather than trying to solve the Riemann problem in terms of Q and also impose this condition, it turns out to be easier to think of decomposing the flux difference. Take the flux in the cell I minus the flux in cell I minus 1, and write that as a linear combination of these eigenvectors, where the R's now are some approximate eigenvectors, again coming from some kind of approximate Riemann solver idea that approximate the right waves for the nonlinear waves in the two materials. And by doing that, by sort of splitting up the flux difference into those eigenvectors rather than splitting up the Q difference, you avoid having to worry about this extra discontinuity here because the flux isn't discontinuous across the interface. It only jumps across the waves. So this is something we've been looking at just recently as a more general approach to handling conservation laws where you have discontinuities in the flux function. So in the case of the elasticity problem, we have an approximate Riemann solver where we have two waves, these waves moving in each material, and you can approximate the speeds and the eigenvectors by just taking the square root of, remember the nonlinear wave speed was the square root of d sigma d epsilon over rho, and we can just approximate that by computing d sigma d epsilon and rho based on the cell averages that we have at each time step, and then use that to define eigenvectors in terms of the corresponding impedance that comes out of that, and then split up the flux difference as a linear combination of those two eigenvectors, and that's exactly the approach that I used for all of the nonlinear examples I showed yesterday. And you can show that even though it sounds like you're doing some approximations there, you end up getting close to second order accuracy. So this was this example I showed yesterday. Actually, there are two different cases, one where the medium was rapidly varying, but continuously the density, say, was a high-frequency sine function rather than being just piecewise constant, the way we looked at yesterday. Here's where it was piecewise constant. In both cases, you get this sort of hump breaking up into this train of solitary waves, as we looked at yesterday. This is at some early time when it's still just breaking up. And we've now solved this on a sequence of grids and look at what sort of accuracy we get. And in the case where the medium is continuous but rapidly varying, we're getting essentially second-order accuracy. And even when it's discontinuous, we're getting better than first-order accuracy, 1.5 or something like that. And you can look at really how accurate is it. In order of accuracy doesn't necessarily mean that much. But you really look at, zoom in on some of these waves. This, again, the strain is discontinuous at each layer interface, while the stress is continuous. What's shown here in each case, the solid line was computed with 100 points per layer. And I think it was on a domain of length 300 or something, so that's 30,000 grid points total, 100 in each layer, so that's a very fine grid solution. And then the X's are shown on other calculations where in this case there were only 4 points per layer, as you can see here, and here 8 points per layer. And you see that even with only 4 points per layer, we're getting a fairly good representation of the solution, and with 8 points per layer, it's pretty much lying right on top. So in spite of the discontinuities here, I guess I should point out that these discontinuities are very different from, say, shock waves that you might be capturing. because these discontinuities are at fixed locations in space where the edges of the layers are, and our grid cells are aligned with those locations so that we always have exactly 4 grid cells per layer. And at the interface between 2 layers, we're solving this Riemann problem that takes into account the jump in the material properties, so we can solve that Riemann problem exactly. And so it's different from a shock capturing problem. You certainly can capture shocks with only 4 points in between them that well, but in this case you can. Okay, so finally, in terms of this question of, do these Riemann solutions shed any light on what's going on in heterogeneous media? And this is something that we've just sort of recently been looking at, so I don't have too much to say, which is good because I'm about out of time again. But I can say something about how you can actually calculate the reflection and transmission coefficients, and then a bit about sort of relation to layered media. So to calculate reflection transmission coefficients, think about a problem where we have just a single wave, a jump discontinuity, that's propagating through one medium and now hits an interface and splits up into transmitted and reflected part. So the initial wave is going to be a right-going wave in this medium on the left. So that means it has to be proportional to this eigenvector ZL1, where ZL is the impedance of the material on the left. So if we didn't have an interface here, that would just propagate forever to the right. But now when it hits the interface, it generates a transmitted and a reflected wave. Well, you can think of that as being a Riemann problem. If we just think about starting at this time right here, then what we have is just a Riemann problem of the sort we were just looking at, where we have QL over here, QR over here, and we also have 2 different material properties, the left and the right. So we can solve that Riemann problem. And when you work out the formulas, what you find is that the left-going wave, which is one going to the left there, has to be some multiple of this eigenvector minus VL1. That's the eigenvector for a left-going wave in the left medium. And the right-going wave has to be a scalar multiple of ZR1, the eigenvector for the right-going waves in the right medium. And you look for what's the right linear combination of those to give you the jump in Q, which is this, and that just gives you these formulas, which show that you can think of it as being the initial wave multiplied by some coefficients, which are exactly the reflection and transmission coefficients in terms of the difference in impedance. Okay, and another thing you can look at, or another way you can think about solving the Riemann problem, is to look in the phase plane or the state space, which very handy for a system of 2 equations where we can draw it here as I didn't label it, but this is the PU plane. P and U are our quantities in the vector Q, going back to just the acoustics equations again, where the eigenvectors are Z1 and minus Z1. So you can think of those as being particular directions in the phase plane. And the idea of solving a Riemann problem, if we have general states Q left and Q right, and Riemann solution should give us 2 waves with some state QM in between, we saw that we could compute these waves by taking the difference in Qs and splitting it up into eigenvectors. Another way to look at that is that we're taking these states QL and QR in this PU plane. They represent some points here, depending on what P and U are in each of those states. And from these eigenvectors, we get certain directions in the plane. In particular, this direction is the direction of all states that could possibly be connected to QL by a jump that lies in the direction of R1. So states on this line are states that can be connected to QL by a one wave, a wave moving to the left. And we want QM to be such a state, since we have a one wave connecting QL and QM. Similarly, through QR, there's a line here in the direction R2, that's the set of all states we could possibly connect to QR by a jump that is a scalar multiple of R2 and therefore propagates as a 2 wave. And we also want QM to be on that line because it should be connected to QR by a 2 wave. So QM has to be the point where those 2 lines intersect. That's the only point in the plane that can be simultaneously connected to QL and QR by appropriate waves. So you can think of solving the Riemann problem graphically this way. Of course, that's exactly what we compute when we do this eigenvalue decomposition. We're just solving a linear system that amounts to finding this intersection. Well, in the heterogeneous case, we're doing something similar. Except now we've got one material to the left, so we've got a sort of phase plane picture that has eigenvectors looking like this, and a different material, so a different impedance, and therefore a different direction for the eigenvectors in the material on the right. And so if we have this Riemann problem with two states and also two materials, and we now want to find two waves that are connected, or that connect each of these to some intermediate state QM, then we can do the same kind of construction, but through QL, we have to look at all the states that can be connected by a wave that's a scalar multiple of this RL. And similarly, through QR, we want to look at all states that could be connected to QR by a two-wave in this material on the right. And so where those two intersect, we get the value QM. Now, the interesting thing about this, I think, is that when you start looking at how do these waves in heterogeneous media look when you look at them in the phase plane, you get some interesting things. So first of all, in just a homogeneous medium, and this is a problem where we've taken the left boundary of some homogeneous material and pulled on it a bit, that sends a stress wave down. Or I guess in this case we've actually pushed on it because the pressure is increasing. Pressure is like negative of stress. But anyway, we have a wave that's moving to the right in this material, and T is just this scalar multiple of U. This wave has to be a multiple of this right-going eigenvector Z1, which means P and U are just scalar multiples of each other. And in fact, the impedance Z was 1 here, so P is actually equal to U. And so if we calculate these characteristic variables, which are sort of when we diagonalize the system, we get, remember, advection equations for W1 and W2 that are the coefficients of the left-going and right-going eigenvectors, then what we find is that we have a right-going wave and we have zero component in the left-going wave, and so this general formula reduces to just being a purely right-going wave of this form. And so if you look in the phase plane, if you took all the states that you compute here, all the values of T and all the values of U, and you plot them together, you're going to get something that starts out at the origin here, and as you go through this hump, it goes up to some value and back down again, but P is always equal to U, so all those points just lie on this 45-degree line. Not very interesting in that case. But in the layered case, as I mentioned, as we saw yesterday, things are more interesting because we have this constant reflection of the interfaces. And so if you have this sort of pressure pulse now going through a layered medium, when you look at W1 and W2, they're both non-zero. Even though the effective behavior is just a wave that's moving to the right, you get a large component in the left-going characteristic variable W1 as well as in the right-going characteristic variable W2. And if you plot the values, again, of P versus U as you take all the points, all your grid points going through this wave, what you find is that they kind of go along a zigzag pattern here. As you go through these different layers, you can see P and U sort of looking somewhat piecewise linear. And in the phase plane, it also looks sort of piecewise linear. It goes up to some value and then back down again. And in this case, they sort of tend to move around a line that has a slope that's given by the effective impedance of this layered material, which it turns out you can work out to be. Impedance is just rho times C, so for the effective material, you take the average density and this effective wave speed that we saw last time, or equivalently, it's the square root of the product of ZL and ZR. And so if you sort of smear out the solutions here and look at an effective equation, you'd see that T and U are roughly related by Z hat, this effective impedance. But there's this interesting sort of fine scale structure where it's moving along lines that have a different slope. Now, First guess might be that these slopes that you're seeing in each layer are related to the eigenvectors R1 and R2 in the layers, but it's actually more complicated than that, because within each layer, you have not just a single right-going wave, you have a combination of right-going and left-going waves. So if you blow up a little piece of this, I've drawn not only these points, but also what we get when we solve the Riemann problems between these points. So this is just looking at, here's a bunch of points that are in one layer, and then there's an interface, and then a bunch of points that are in the other layer. And this was part of the other curve as it goes back down. But what we get is, between two adjacent points, say QI minus 1 and QI, when we solve the Riemann problem, we're actually getting waves that lie in the direction of R1 and R2 relative to that material. If we're in the A layer, they're the eigenvectors for material A, or if they're in the B layer, they're the eigenvectors for the material B. But what looks like a constant slope here isn't the slope of either of those eigenvectors, nor is it the slope of the effective medium, which is some average slope. It's some other slope altogether, which I don't completely understand yet, but there's some interesting sort of coupling conditions between these, because at the corner here where we jump from one layer to the other, so these two blue points represent points in grid cells just on either side of the layer, we have to have a Riemann solution that's coupled with a one wave from layer A and a two wave from layer B. And so there's a very particular angle that you have to have here in order for things to fit together properly. So as I said, this is something we're sort of just starting to look at, and I don't have very much understanding yet of whether this way of looking at things is useful, but the hope is that by sort of understanding better what's going on in layered medium by looking at these Riemann solutions and how things fit together, maybe we can also carry that over to understand in the nonlinear case what happens with these solitary waves of the sort that we were looking at last time, where you get waves that are really concentrated in only a few layers. And is there a way to sort of see exactly what the structure of these waves is within these layers? But I will stop here for now. And on Thursday, I'll carry on and talk a little bit about multidimensional problems, both finite volume methods and a bit about elasticity problems and heterogeneous media, as well as a bit about other applications. And then also talk about some of this general purpose software we've developed that implements these algorithms in a way that they can be applied fairly broadly. So thanks very much. Let's see, are there any questions?
Yeah.